My name is Mark Levinson. I'm a senior fellow at EPI and the co-director with Ross Eisenbray of the Agenda for Shared Prosperity. And this session is on unions, the economy, and employee free choice. That workers in the United States in the year 2007 do not have an effective right to organize unions is many things. It's an international embarrassment that our laws do not comply with the most basic international standards. It's a moral outrage that these same laws violate basic tenets of American democracy. It's a political constraint on developing a social movement for a more just society. And it is bad for the economy, a major source of inefficiency and inequality. No one has made these series of interconnected arguments on behalf of unions more clearly, more passionately, more knowledgeably, more persuasively than our next speaker, Harley Shaken. Harley has written widely on unions, globalization, economic development. He is the class of 1930 professor at the Graduate School of Education and Department of Geography at the University of California, Berkeley. And we are honored to have him here today.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here today, and I'd like to thank EPI for organizing the Agenda on Shared Prosperity and for the event today. I think it makes a key contribution to reframing a critical debate. What I'm going to do today, very briefly, is talk about a central paradox. On the one hand, a record number of people indicate they would join a union if they could. The most recent Peter Hart poll shows close to 60% of non-management employees say that. Yet a record number of people on the low side are now members of labor unions, as we know in the private sector, 7.4%. How do we explain that growing gap between preference and reality? And I think one leading explanation that represents a pivotal part of that gap is it has become in the United States today a risk rather than a right to join a labor union. As Tom Cochin pointed out, in 2005, 31,000 workers in the United States were disciplined or even fired for their labor activity. This compares to roughly 1,300 workers in 1958. That results in what amounts to a democracy deficit. As we've seen in the remarks earlier today, it squeezes the middle class. The word that comes to mind for so many Americans in the middle class today is not prosperity, it's insecurity. It weakens progressive politics. Imagine struggling for a minimum wage or health care or any part of the social safety net without a labor movement at the core of that struggle. And most fundamentally, this democracy deficit undermines democracy itself. George P. Shultz, former Secretary of State, former Treasury Secretary, former Secretary of Labor, was unambiguous. He put it, free societies and free trade unions go together. And then he elaborated on that by saying, Any healthy workplace needs a system of checks and balances. Today, we've lost that system for almost 93% of our private sector workplaces. But even that alarming number of a little over 7% union density understates how severe the situation has become. If you go to South Carolina, the lowest union density in the country, in the private sector, 1.9% of the workforce are union members. That approaches a rounding error. And I think it does reflect this larger institutional failure. So what I'd like to do today is look at three themes: the great disconnect, the high road, and what an alternative might look like to the dysfunctional system of labor rights in place today. In the context of the great disconnect, which I believe is the period we are living through today, we are seeing rising prosperity in the abstract, certainly rising productivity, and real wages stagnant or even declining. For 90% of the population, they have become observers rather than participants in a growing economy. Historically and today, the most pivotal institution that forges and sustains a link between growing productivity and rising wages is the labor movement. If the labor movement weakens, that link that has harnessed wages to productivity erodes, and that results in a squeeze in the middle class and the level of insecurity that has become so pervasive today. As Paul Krugman put it, one can debate the extent of the gap, but no one was debating it in the early 1970s in terms of a broadly shared prosperity that is clearly absent today. Even Henry Paulson, when he became Treasury Secretary late last year, at the end of the summer, said, "Amid this country's strong economic expansion, many Americans simply aren't feeling the benefits." As Larry Michel's work has shown, since 2000, productivity has risen by 20%. Real wages have crept up somewhere between 2 and 3% over this period. A quarter of all workers today work for poverty-level wages, a number that has gone up since 2001. And we know the work of Robert Gordon and Ian Dubecker that the bottom 90% over a sustained period from 1966 onward have really either not shared in the productivity growth or been totally knocked out of it. At the same time, profits as a share of national income have risen from 7% in 2001 to 12% in 2006. Now, unions address this great disconnect in some very important ways. Clearly, there is the union advantage, that is, the increased wages and benefits that union members achieve compared to non-union members in the society. The BLS tells us it's 28% for wages, 44% for total compensation, but there are many other studies that more carefully adjust for differences of experience, region, industry. They all show a significant union advantage from 15% onwards. But it is an advantage that disproportionately benefits those at the bottom and the middle of the wage scale. In other words, it allows entry into the middle class, and it strengthens the middle class. It is a wage advantage and a benefit advantage that disproportionately benefits people of color, which reduces, to some degree, the historic gaps based on race and ethnicity that have existed. But it goes beyond simply benefiting people at the low and middle of the wage. it really has impacted more broadly this great disconnect historically and served at periods when unions were much stronger to result in a more equal, more widely shared prosperity. I'd like to look at several dimensions of this. One, the bargaining strategy at a period when unions were very strong, at the end of the Second World War. In a cold winter of 1945, there were unusually tough negotiations between the United Auto Workers and General Motors, reflecting throughout American manufacturing and really throughout the economy a sense of pent-up wage demand from the Second World War. So the UAW made a demand at General Motors to increase wages by 30%, which seems like a lot, but it's reflecting all the pent-up demand of, in effect, the Depression and the Second World War. But there was another dimension to what Walter Reuther demanded that in some ways was as or even more significant. A 30% wage increase without raising the price of the car. The notion was that auto workers should benefit, but that the whole society ought to benefit from the improvements in productivity. It was a 106-day strike. The UAW didn't really win by any means all that it asked for, but it laid the basis for a proposal that Charles Wilson, the president of GM, soon to become Secretary of Defense in the Eisenhower administration, made in 1948. That was a wage bargain that would seek to benefit auto workers and spread the benefits of productivity to the broader society. It had two components. First, an annual improvement factor, not based on productivity in the industry, among the most productive in the world in those years, but an annual productivity improvement that would reflect the broad tracking of productivity in the society, the notion that auto workers would benefit, but so would the consumer. The second component to that was a cost of living increase to ensure that time didn't erode these gains. The union accepted that and secured it not simply for auto workers, but as a pattern that diffused throughout the American economy for much of the next 20, 30 years, a pattern that was pivotal in ensuring this link between growing productivity and the health and well-being of the middle class. But as unions weakened, this grand bargain became far more difficult to sustain. Not the only issue by any means, but a pivotal dimension in the erosion of the middle class and in the economic impacts that that's had on wages and benefits. But the second dimension of what unions have done, in addition to what they've done at the bargaining table, is they have been a central political force for legislation over much of the post-war period on the minimum wage, on health care, on Social Security, on unemployment compensation, that has benefited their own members, to be sure, but has laid a broader foundation for a progressive coalition and for that element of security for the middle class. A powerful impact of this more broadly in terms of the union advantage, as we know, not simply in terms of union members, but the way this diffuses to the non-union sector of the society. Simply put, the union threat effect. If you don't want a union, sophisticated employers have tended to track union wages and benefits. Let me give a very specific, very recent example from a troubled industry, the auto industry. Till very recently, the major international automakers operating in the U.S. tracked UAW wages negotiated at a bargaining table in Detroit. So this year, for example, Toyota wound up having a higher wage, although a smaller total compensation, than, say, Ford or General Motors workers, $30 an hour versus $27 an hour, because of that tracking, because as a union avoidance strategy, the company was paying high wages. But with the crisis in the industry and with the broader crisis among unions, that is the declining density, what Toyota has decided to do is very different. A few weeks ago, they announced their profits for last year, both for the final quarter of 2006 and for the total year. They were record profits. Well, what would a company want to do when they announce record profits? Well, it turns out Toyota circulated an internal memo from very high levels in the company saying what we really have to do now is lower our wages significantly. That to date, we have tracked our competitors in the industry. That is no longer the appropriate benchmark. What we have to begin with is the wages paid in each of the states in which we operate. So with the current wage of $30, the benchmark for Kentucky, where Toyota is headquartered and has much of its manufacturing, is $12.64 an hour. But then the memo continues. And we need to look internationally at labor costs, which are 50% of U.S. cost in Japan and France, numbers that are arguable, but this is what the memo says. And then it goes on to say, and by the way, we pay one-fifth in Mexico of what the wages are in the United States. At a period of record profitability, a strategic memo to lower wages significantly. Does that sound like a strategy for securing a middle class? Does that sound like a direction that is going to link competitive success with social well-being for most Americans? And I think an important dimension of this is linked to the notion of weakening of unions in the economy. That leads me to the second point I'd like to make, the high road to competitive success, which Beth Shulman and Tom Cohen, you know, have recently spoken about, I think, with such eloquence and precision. For many analysts viewing the scene today, they would argue, sure, there's a union advantage. That's the problem, not the solution. U.S. workers have become overpaid, a combination of employers asleep at the switch and greedy unions have priced the U.S. out of the global market. That's an interesting argument that I'll address very briefly in a moment, but it has little to do with the 89% of the U.S. economy that is not involved in terms of employment, that isn't involved in manufacturing. But even for the 11% involved in manufacturing, it is a very misleading argument because it is based on an implied assumption that unions might be nice, but they cause lower productivity, higher costs, and we can no longer afford them in a global economy. In fact, that's not what the evidence shows. If you look at the macro studies on productivity, most indicate that increased productivity and unionization can go hand in hand. A 1995 World Bank study, for example, concluded that unions can help raise workplace productivity and reduce workplace discrimination. But the story really ultimately isn't told with these macro studies on either side of the productivity issue. It's really told by what can take place in individual workplaces and the key relationship between rising productivity, rising wages, and the need of unions to secure that long term. Of course, the most famous example of this takes place in a non-union setting. January 1914, a cold winter in Detroit once again. I'm from Detroit, so I have a certain remembrance of cold winters. Henry Ford announces he is doubling the prevailing wage in the automobile industry, doubling it to $5 a day. Why? He had introduced the moving assembly line. Productivity shot up, but so did his turnover. It was impossible to keep workers even at double the prevailing wage. Now, today, the argument might be that a CEO of a company would get up and say, well, our productivity is up, but this is incredibly competitive industry, we're going to cut our prevailing wage in half. But he doubled it and then went on to experience in the next year declining costs for the car, which he cut because productivity had gone up so highly. Sales went way up, and the profitability of the Ford Motor Company jumped by 20%. An enlightened employer, to be sure, but it took the emergence of the labor movement in mass production industries in the 1930s to cement that link, which by then had well eroded for economic and employer pressures. Today, a good union management relationship can result in very high productivity, very strong competitiveness, and high wages. That is the high road. And as Beth and Tom mentioned, this is taking place in any number of leading firms. I'd like to briefly touch on two. One, retailing, the example of Walmart, not the high road, and Costco. To make the comparison more accurate, it would be Sam's Club, the Walmart affiliate that competes most directly in the same sector as Costco. Costco pays wages 40% above Walmart wages on average. Yet its profit, by virtually any measure, is significantly higher than Sam's Club. If you look at, if you use as the metric the profitability per employee, Costco is almost double the profitability of Sam's Club. If you look at profitability per square foot, significantly higher. How does this happen? Well, the CEO and founder of Costco puts it very directly. If you have a high wage strategy, you can lower your cost. It almost echoes what Henry Ford said decades earlier when he said, in terms of the $5 day, that it's the finest cost-cutting move he ever made. And a low-wage business is inherently an insecure business. One measure of what improves turnover. At Sam's Club, 21% annually. At Costco, 6%. Tens of millions of dollars are involved in turnover, directly in terms of training, indirectly in terms of the quality of the service, the productivity, et cetera. So clearly there is this possibility, but there's also the danger, because even an enlightened employer, without the pressure of a countervailing check and balance, a union, is going to notice that at any given level of quality and productivity, you can cut wages and make more money. But what is not so very apparent that moment, next quarter it will absolutely show up like that, is you erode the very basis of the quality and productivity in the first place, which rests on this sense of higher wages, stronger security, and that elusive but pivotal but fundamental dignity on the job. One of the real essential contributions of trade unionism. Another troubled industry, auto. Again, the notion is that the problem with the Big Three or the Detroit Three has been its wage and benefit package, which is unsustainable. Wages and benefits are important costs, but competitiveness always rests on more than wages and benefits. It rests on innovation, on productivity, on quality, all of which are related to the sense of security that are brought forth. So if you look at a unionized plant such as NUMMI, New United Motor Manufacturing Incorporated, the joint Toyota General Motors partnership in Fremont, California, it's one of the most profitable and successful plants in the United States, yet it has one of the highest wage packages in the United States. If you look at issues of productivity in the auto industry, the most recent numbers from Harbor Consulting, which is used extensively in the industry, indicates of the three most productive plants in the United States, two of the three, number one and number two, are unionized. If you look at the top 10 plants in the United States, auto assembly plants in terms of productivity, 6 of the top 10 are unionized. The problems of the domestic industry are very real, but they reflect severe managerial miscalculation in terms of the vehicles that were built, the markets they chose to compete in, and a failure to adjust to changing realities of oil prices, not wages and benefits. To sustain a high road requires more than a reform of the labor relations system. That's clear, as Beth and Tom mentioned, in the context of the social contract. In manufacturing in particular, it only becomes sustainable with minimally a trade policy that reflects issues of labor rights and environmental protections, that is internationalist in scope, but establishes rules of the game that spur broadly shared development in developing economies and ensure a sustained prosperity in middle class in the U.S. And it requires public policy that deals with issues that directly impact competitiveness, such as labor costs, concerning legacy questions, principally pensions and health care. That brings me to the final point. What are the alternatives? I think to talk seriously about a high road, to talk seriously about progressive politics more broadly, we need a labor movement that is strong and is vital. And that requires workers exercising in practice the central right that they still have in the books, to make an informed and free choice on whether or not they want a union. The Wagner Act, hailed as labor's Magna Carta at the time, still hailed as labor's Magna Carta on the website of the Department of Labor, has really, for all practical purposes, been repealed in the workplace. It exists on the book, but 70 years of amendment, of judicial decision, of administrative decisions through the NLRB and other agencies have eroded that practice on the ground. As we know, and I'd like to just very briefly speak about the mechanism here, when 30% or more of workers in a workplace sign a petition for a union, the NLRB schedules an election within generally a month or two, sometimes much longer, but on average it's about 44 days. But that period becomes a period of intimidation, because an employer that doesn't skirt the law has unlimited options, from mandatory meetings to barring union representatives from the premises. But for any employer that really wants to keep a union out, skirting the law has very, very minimal penalties. And employers increasingly go down that route, as the 31,000 number for 2005 on disciplines and firings, or the study that indicates one out of every five union organizers winds up being fired in representation campaigns. The Employee Free Choice Act, at its core, is I think, simple, very straightforward. The notion that a majority plus one in a workplace signing up will secure a union, and real penalties for violations of labor law and an insurance of getting to that first contract. What about the secret ballot election? In a democracy, we hold the secret ballot sacred, appropriately. But the secret ballot is only as effective as the context in which the vote takes place. The context today is overwhelmingly coercive when it comes to this period between petition and when the vote takes place. The authors of the Wagner Act, from Senator Wagner on down, all recognize that. When the Wagner Act was drafted, it was unambiguous that it meant to give workers the right to choose and to keep the employer out of the picture. 1938, 1939, over one-third, or close to one-third, of all recognitions of unions under the National Labor Relations Act took place without an election. But it we don't have to just look to the commentary when the National Labor Relations Act was passed. We can go back to the Federalist paper. Alexander Hamilton was quite clear when he said, in the main, it will be found that a power over a man's support is a power over his will, end quote. That is, the economic power of the employer inherently creates an unbalanced situation. But what exists today under the actual use of the NLRA in practice goes well beyond that. That said, what about two key issues concerning the Employee Free Choice Act? The secrecy of the vote with the secret ballot compared to what a majority sign-up would entail, and the issue of pressure on a worker in terms of making the decision outside the secret ballot polling booth. Let me start with the pressure issue. On any contested issue, there is going to be strong pressure on both sides. Yes, co-workers will pressure you to vote for or against a union. But that's pressure. Only the employer has the real power of coercion. No union member or organizer can determine whether or not you're going to be transferred to a new department, what your promotional possibilities are going to be, whether or not you're even going to have a job. So yes, there is pressure, but on both sides. But coercion is what takes place today, not at the ballot box necessarily, but in that intervening period. The second point, secrecy. Yes, in a secret ballot election under the NLRA today, the identity and vote of an individual worker is not public. But the identity of the unit and vote of the unit is very public. The famed case at Walmart a decade or so ago in Texas, at three Walmart units where meat cutters decided and voted for having a union. And Walmart, not knowing the identity of the individual worker, very visibly shut down their entire internal meat cutting operations. That, needless to say, exerted a chilling effect that's still with us. But the notion of secrecy as being defining really is not what takes place here. Ultimately, what happens is under these rules of the game, a secret ballot election in practice does not register so much the preference of informed and free choice as the fear and coercion that leads up to that election. In that regard, under the NLRA today, these elections have more the character of a plebiscite under a dictatorship than an informed vote in a democracy. 1982 in Chile, there was a secret ballot election on whether or not to continue the dictatorship. By most accounts, the actual voting was honest. Very few would argue that it was representative of a free and informed choice. The Employee Free Choice Act is hardly a magic solution to the problems of labor or to the addressing of a new social contract. It is, however, a realistic, important, and modest next step that opens up democracy in the workplace and, as a result, can strengthen the middle class, result in a more vibrant coalition for progressive politics, and ultimately strengthen the very nature of democracy itself. On those grounds, it is important in its own right, in restoring a right that was widely hailed and pivotal to any democratic society, but also results as a key step towards the kind of society that we would like to see. Thank you.
have time for a few questions.
Okay, sure.
You should have to end at 11:35.
Great. To make this straightforward, I will give the answers, and then you can ask the questions.
Quick question. So if it's true that a unionized firm experiences higher productivity in the ways you describe, is it irrational for firms to be union busters? And if it's not irrational, why? I guess one question is, does a high road strategy entail certain risks that are greater than a low road strategy? So it's high risk, high reward, and so maybe it is rational from a profit maximizing perspective to be union busting? Or is it not necessarily a profit reason why it would be rational, but it goes to issues of power and flexibility that the employer wants to retain in the workplace?
Okay. Is a union's avoidance strategy then rational or irrational? And I would say there are two dimensions to that question. On one level, I think there is ample evidence that a strong working relationship between a union and an employer can result in a more stable workplace, higher productivity, and improved quality, and ultimately more innovation and a more competitive and successful firm. Then why don't all employers see that if presented with the evidence? Because they are operating in addition under a different set of constraints which concern short-term profitability, share value, and increasingly executive compensation. At any given level of productivity, quality, and competitiveness, you can make more money by lowering wages. So if you want to raise your profit margin next quarter, why not do that? That makes a lot of sense. So they're not being irrational. They're responding rationally to the wrong set of rules of the game.
With the time horizon problem.
The time horizon is central to that. Then there are other ideological issues in terms of control of the enterprise, et cetera. But I think there's no question one can make the case very convincingly that a union and an employer can work together to the mutual benefit of both, let alone the entire society. But the reason so many employers increasingly don't see that is the time horizons under which they're working, the rules of the game as to how performance is measured, and I think that it winds up being short-sighted for the firm and damaging for the society.
Kind of a devil's advocate position or statement, if you will, I think. Listening to most of the presentations this afternoon, especially yours, for example, suggests two things, that the American worker and American business is poorly informed. Mm-hmm. They really don't have the facts at their fingertips, otherwise they would embrace unionism. Mm-hmm. Secondly, that the issue of workers themselves, that is the dominant society, if we peel back the notion of let's inform the worker on the one hand, and let's get rid of an oppressive organization that intimidates workers, then the problem is solved. Okay. An observation, I've been teaching at a fairly large university in the city of Chicago for about 35 years, courses of work in the economy. Most of my students from liberal arts or the College of Commerce are second and third generation blue collar background. Typically, at the end of my classes, I'll ask the students, I'll go through economic inequality and a series of things, and I'll say, okay, labor unions, part of the problem, part of the solution. Two-thirds or more, every single time, part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I say that flies in the face of the notion that we've got all these workers out here, you know, dying to join unions. I'm saying that there's another part of that onion that needs to get peeled back, and I just don't think it's labor's or a business's problem of oppressing workers on the one hand, and the notion that if we freed up some of these issues, we'd have them solved. I think it goes a lot deeper than that. We've got a culture that, by and large, is anti-union, you know, and not ready to embrace it.
You know, I won't disagree with you fully. There are some points that you're raising that I would take a little bit of issue. I think you're raising an important point. I raised the Peter Hart poll, 58%. This is a poll that took place in December. There are other polls that show much narrower margins. Gallup a number of years ago, and I know Richard Freeman is going to speak about this next, said 32%. I don't imagine that if Employee Free Choice Act is passed tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, 60% of the workforce will be unionized. But I think it will be more than it is today. It opens up an option. Many workers are anti-union. They've accepted a more prevalent ideology that the union is not a democratic right, it's a third party, which is the prevailing ideology, I think, of employers in this country today. What I think the Employee Free Choice Act does is provide, in a modest way, additional options that could be very beneficial to workers and could, in effect, make the campaign in practice for a union a more evenly matched one. And I think in that regard, it represents a major step forward from where we are today. I don't think unions are going to disappear, but if they decline much lower, they will cease to be an effective social and political force in the society. And then I think that has implications that go well beyond the economic questions we've been talking about. One more question.
David Brooks with La Jornada newspaper. You've been discussing this democracy deficit and this democracy deficit in Latin America, we understand that is more of something, it's part of what's called neoliberal politics. And so from my understanding of the discussion today and what you've been saying is that essentially what's all these consequences are the result of neoliberal politics applied to the United States. The question is, in Latin America, we've seen through Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, in Mexico, questions of a rebellion against these very policies, very explicitly, just specifically against these kind of policies here. Do you see any signs of that same kind of rebellion in the United States? And if so, where would you point to as where it's happening? Would it be this last election? Would it be some of the polls, et cetera? Is there any parallel? Are we beginning to see the North following the South?
I think we are seeing some important parallels, and I would give two. One is the most recent congressional election, where the level of unease and the way the issues were raised, particularly in some key states such as Ohio, indicate the insecurity translating into something other than poll numbers. I have to say, even though I was very liberal in using poll numbers, I'm always a bit suspicious of polls alone. Most Americans said they wanted to drink new Coke when they were polled on it. It didn't quite work out that way. That said, this recent election and the character of the upcoming presidential campaign, I think, is beginning to embody many of these issues. On the ground, there is surprising and deep insecurity among so many millions of people, particularly those in the middle class or those who would have aspired to the middle class, not simply about whether or not they're going to have a job, but what happens to your pension, what happens to your health care, what happens if you can no longer work. Etc. So I think that vast insecurity is translating into unease, which has an expression at the ballot box. And I think in that regard, this is taking place today. That's why it is such an important and opportune moment to talk about a pivotal dimension of that, which is the role of the labor movement in any democracy and in this democracy and politically in this society right now. Thank you.
So we're now going to try something new and different. Besides the fact that we're in this lovely room, anybody been in here in the last 12 years? It's really great. Our last speaker is Richard Freeman, who unfortunately, because of the teaching responsibilities, couldn't be here. But he's going to be able to talk, we hope and expect, over this speakerphone on the cell phone here. And so just to introduce Richard, my good friend, who's a Harvard professor, leading researcher at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and in my view, the leading labor market economist in the country, if not the world. So, Richard, can you do this one? Okay. Let's try it, Richard.
Okay, I hear you fine. Do you hear me?
Well, you're kind of tinny, but we can hear you.
Should I yell?
You're doing fine. You're doing fine.
Okay. Let me discuss very briefly this briefing paper, because it's got one clear message, which surprised me when I looked at the data. And I mean, the title is "Do Workers Still Want Unions?" In 1995-96, when the Clinton administration was concerned about labor management issues, we did this national survey, which found that a large fraction of American workers wanted unions but didn't have them. There was 32% of the non-union workers who said they wanted unions and were unable to get union representation. Since then, the fraction who are unionized in the private sector has continued to fall. Since then, various public opinion groups have taken some of the questions that I and my co-author Joel Rogers used and have asked them at various times to national samples of workers, or in some cases it's to a California sample of workers. The surprise when I looked at those data is that the fraction of workers who want unions has risen, and it's risen fairly substantially. The first time ever, in 2003 and 2005, we see over half non-union workers say they would like union representation. The numbers before that would have been around a third. So it's a very large increase. We were sufficiently conservative or not sure this could be such a big this was true. Then we went and looked at various other questions. And there, Gallup poll, for instance, has done questions for years on do people approve or disapprove of unions. And what we found there is an increase in approval of unions. And you look at a whole host of other questions, some of which are in the EPI briefing paper, and some of which are in the 2006 version of our book where we updated things, what workers want, that there's been an increase. As unionization has fallen in the U.S., more and more workers feel that they want that representation. Now you can ask your question, why are they not getting this representation? And how does the U.S. compare to other countries? Well, both in our survey and in the more recent surveys of the last 10 years, workers clearly are aware that to get a union is a big battle. And workers want cooperative relations with management. They don't want to go to war with their employer any more than anyone wants to go to war with their spouse. That is not a good thing. And so management opposition clearly deters a lot of union drives, according to workers. And I would say, if management opposition was not deterring things, management would not be spending a lot of resources opposing unions. So that's a big issue. People not this market, if you think of it as a market, this market is not giving people what they want. Just one side of the market is opposed to that. And then we've done some work looking at the U.S. and the other five major Anglo-Saxon countries, or Anglo-American countries. It's close to Ireland, Celtic country, but it's Canada, Ireland, the U.K., New Zealand, and Australia. The U.S. has the largest fraction of people who want unions and cannot get them of any of these countries. That's first. And then there's a second interesting aspect. Is in many of these countries, people have intermediate groups. In Britain, they're going to have the Works Council. councils. Ireland has works councils from the European Union. But the Australians and the New Zealand folk and even the Canadians have something that's weaker than a union, doesn't do collective bargaining, but which represents workers. So the U.S. in that sense sticks out as a sore thumb in both respects. And obviously I think that this is something we should try to remedy and correct so our workers have the same democracy, democratic rights, and insights, and are able to contribute in their firm as they want to. That's all I'll say.
Okay, thanks, Jerry. Well, hold on a second. For those people who may not have gotten everything that he said, I'm just going to summarize it briefly. In the mid-1990s, there was a lot of attention to the Dunlop Commission and the issue of unionization and changing the labor law. At that time, Richard Freeman and Joel Rogers did surveys consulting a lot of engagement with all sorts of people concerned to try to figure out what the workers themselves say they want. At that point, they identified that of non-managerial workers in the private sector, about 33% of the non-union, non-managerial workers wanted to have a union if they could have it the next week. What he's done in this paper is to update that, looking at various surveys, primarily from the Hart and Associates, and finds that for the first time in 2003 and 2005, more than half of the non-union workforce says they want a union. If you believe the numbers about in the mid-1990s, and if you take all the people that were non-union and wanted a union, and all the people who were union and wanted to stay union, we would have had a unionization rate of around 44%. If you update that to 2005, it would be 58%. So there's this giant gap between what people are saying they want and what they're getting, as referred to by Harley and others. Richard is then also saying that they did this same survey in five advanced English-speaking countries, and by far, uniquely large gap between what people want in terms of union representation and what they get is present in the United States versus Ireland, Canada, the UK, New Zealand, and Australia. And in these other countries, this is sometimes also have other forms of worker representation short of collective bargaining that we don't have here as well. So we're very short of worker representation, and it's about time we got it. Right, Richard?
That's correct.
Okay. So maybe one or two questions that people have, I can relate it to Richard, and we're sorry for the technical difficulties. There were special rules that wouldn't allow us to hook into their own phone system. It's a very ethical conference we're having. Not using their facilities. Any questions? Go on. One question. Go on.
What are these other representative
forms? Richard, there's a question about what are these other representative forms you've talked about, and should they be part of our dialogue? And I guess in so speaking about them, you should also differentiate them from the kind of TEAM Act committees that we sometimes hear about.
Yeah, the other forms, the strongest forms, are the European Works Councils, because they are mandated by law, and they are very explicit about what management must do to meet with the workers, discuss problems. They differ across European countries. They're local, workplace-based. And you have an election, so the local people elect their representatives to discuss matters with management. That's the strongest form, because it's legally mandated.
Right. See, these are legally mandated opportunities for people to elect a works council that has discussions with management, and I would add, over everything. Collective bargaining actually talks about, obligates employers to talk about wages, hours, and working conditions. Works Council deals with fundamental issues of investment and everything across the board. So in one way, it's actually a more radical concept. In other ways, it doesn't deal with some of the wage, hour, working condition issues that collective bargaining handles, because in these countries that have them, they're handled otherwise.
Right. The other groups that do this, there are staff associations in the UK that do not do collective bargaining, that are formed by workers, and management recognizes and discusses issues with them. Where you don't have a collective bargaining contract, and it goes up fairly high up the hierarchy. So you could have lower-level management be in an association that discusses issues with the employer.
Okay, I just want to commend everybody to read the paper. I think it's probably easier than hearing Richard. Richard, we're going to go now. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.